Since we were together last Sunday morning, I've had some experiences that I genuinely wish all of you could have shared with me. You contribute liberally of your means, and this makes possible support of the work in many places, gospel preachers who are spreading the gospel. But it seems sometimes that I'm the one that has the opportunity to visit and see the people that are doing the work and enjoy the marvelous satisfaction of this fellowship that we have together with them. I'd like to share with you just a little of my experiences. I left here Lord's Day just after the morning service and drove to Winston-Salem, where I held a meeting about 4 years ago, and they were meeting in a little residence, rather old and not particularly attractive. But they had been struggling along there for a long period of time. They had a preacher that was supported from outside as well as from the congregation, doing about all they could do to support him. This time when I went back, I found considerable difference. Not long after I was there, the preacher left them, and they decided to do their own preaching. And so they did their own preaching for a period of time and put their resources into the building of a new building, and they have a very lovely building now, and the congregation is growing. Jeff Young is working there with our support, with their support, with the support of several other congregations, and a number of them came to me and said, be sure and tell Ember Hills we appreciate so much what they're doing in helping Jeff to stay here, and they have a very high regard for Jeff and his wife and children, and are just thankful that they have the opportunity of having them there. A part of that growth has certainly been a result of the good work of the Hayes family, the Smith's daughter, Sandy, and her husband, Wally, and their children, two of whom we have here with us just now, and we're so glad to have them with us. I found that they had about 70 in the morning service. They have a number of people that come from considerable distance who were not able to return in the evening, but even the evening service was a good service, good lesson from Jeff. And then after the service, the whole congregation stayed together to do what our groups do. They went through and checked on people that were absent, talked about their visitors, noted people who had just moved to town, the importance of getting out and trying to contact them. They were taking notes and apparently making a real effort to spread the gospel and to reach out to the lost and to encourage the saved who might be weak and need encouragement in that city. Well, I believe that we can feel very confident about the support we're giving there. Then I went on from there to Richmond and spent Monday through Friday night staying with Albert and Debbie Dixon and their two fine young sons who I just love and appreciate. I don't think I've ever seen two finer children than those two children, and of course they're reflections of good parents. Congregation, you've been supporting Albert for many years, probably 8 or 9 years, since he worked here with us in this congregation. And the work there was very discouraging for a while, and I really wasn't aware of considerable growth that's taken place within the last year. The church is still not large, but it's made up of very substantial, stable people, and I believe the future is bright. We met in the YMCA each night. We had to get there early and get the chairs out, and those chairs consisted first of all of folding chairs, and then behind that we went and got some cushion chairs out of the conference room every night, and then behind that there were desk chairs, and these were all filled up not only with people from the congregation who brought their friends and neighbors, but also from visiting congregations. Last night, Friday night it was, kind of went wild, and we had to get out in the gymnasium. But we had plenty of room there, but still had a chair problem and a heat problem. But I told them that they'll look back on those days someday and rejoice that they were a part of that congregation when it was just getting started. And I believe the future is bright for that work. And I would just, and again, they express their appreciation for Albert and the work he's doing and for the support that's being given from this congregation. And I would just like to urge you, if you are up that way, either to Winston-Salem or Richmond, that you look in on those congregations if you have any opportunity to do so. They'd love to have you. In fact, they told me in Richmond that I believe Paula Hovater had visited there with them, and also Catherine Youngblood and Nikki, I believe, came by and visited with them, and it was just a real encouragement to them, and you would be an encouragement also. Speaking of small beginnings, this congregation began meeting in a school building, and in fact I mentioned that to the church there to encourage them. And among those who visited, who worshiped in the congregation for a little while in the school building, were Les and Sarah Jones. And they have been in and out with us from time to time, and have been with us now for the last 2 or 3 years. I don't know just how long. But they're leaving us, and this morning is their last service. They'll be going up into the Detroit area, where they're very much needed and will be a great blessing, even as they have been in the past. But we're hoping that it won't be too long till they'll show up down here again. They, as I said, they've been in and out. They're going out, but we look forward to being back in sometime in the future. Pray that God will bless them and Matthew and Christy as they go, though Christy, I believe, will be here with us some in the future. We pray for them and pray for all God's people. Seemed to me there was something else that I intended to mention, but I guess that's enough for now. We've got to get on with things, the thoughts we have in mind for the lesson this morning. I just suspect, and I hope, that the very effective reading that James did of John, the first chapter, verses 1 through 13, I trust that that reading brought to your mind the lesson that we had last Lord's Day. We observed that from the very beginning of time, there was another person with the one we think of as God, from the very beginning, creating with him another and their others in their own image. God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." And we saw that this second person of the Godhead made numerous appearances during Old Testament history, and we actually just touched the hem of the garment in noting those appearances of this one who was not an angel, certainly not a man, was worshipped as God, and yet made just brief appearances from time to time among the people of God. John identified him in the text that James read as the Word, who was in the beginning with God, the same was God. All things were made by him. Without him was not anything made that hath been made. And then John said in the next verse, after where we stopped, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." And in the first chapter of the book of 1 John, John says, "Our hands have handled him. We saw him. We heard him. We experienced him among us," and it's evident that he was speaking of none other than the one named Jesus, whom we also recognize as the Christ, the Messiah. And we went on to observe that there had been predictions of the coming of this Messiah, going far back into the very beginning of time, that there would come one who was the seed of the woman, who would bruise the serpent's head. Then we observed that in Abraham's seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And that Jacob blessed his sons, and particularly Judah, saying, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah till Shiloh come, to whom it belongs." And then we observed from David that God promised him a son whose kingdom would last forever. And then from Isaiah, that a virgin would conceive and bring forth a son, and you'd call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And from Micah, that he would be born in the city of Bethlehem. And again from Isaiah, that he would be arrested after being despised and rejected, that he would be tried and given no justice, cut off out of the land of the living for the transgressions of my people. And then from the psalmist, we even read some of the words that he would speak on the cross and the manner in which he would be treated while he was on the cross. And then the promise of his resurrection. Now, these are not unfamiliar things, I think, to most of us. We've been familiar with this. And yet it is very easy for us in thinking of Jesus to think of him as being more of a legendary kind of character than a real, genuine individual who lived and dwelt among the sons of men. Is Jesus real? This is the question that we want to ask this morning and determine as best we can. And I don't know why this is not working. Does anybody know? Well, we'll just get along without it. Is Jesus real? Very often, young people, I think, especially, who grow up in school where many questions are raised about all of the people of the past, begin to wonder if maybe Jesus might be something like, well, if they've studied English literature, they've read about Beowulf, this being rather shady kind of person that lived centuries and centuries ago. Or they've read about King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table, but they've been told nobody really knows whether a King Arthur ever lived or not. Or they've read about Paul Bunyan and all of his escapades up in the North Woods. And even more, perhaps, about Santa Claus, of whom they've heard since they were little. And they've seen all these pictures of Santa Claus, and they've heard all these legends, and they're not certain whether it was a Saint Nick that came out of, what is, Holland, or what, just who he was, but there was probably somebody back there, but all of this has grown up around him, and we really don't know anything about whether he really was, but there's great benefit in knowing about this kind of character, and we can be generous and giving as he was, and partake of the spirit of this great. Is that what Jesus is? Is that all that Jesus is? There are several questions that we want to ask about Jesus this morning, and I'll just introduce those questions to you. We want to ask the question, how does Jesus differ from the legendary heroes of other cultures? Is Jesus actually mentioned outside the Bible? If Jesus did not live, what's the source of the concept of his character? And finally, are there any tangible evidences of his life here upon the earth? Now let's look at that first question. How does Jesus differ from Beowulf, from King Arthur, or even from Santa Claus? What's the difference? Well, there are a great many differences. But I want to begin by telling you that you can date the time of Jesus' life and go to the very city where he was born and to the very town where he grew up, and you can be confident that this is the very place where he lived and worked among men. Now, that is not true of Beowulf. It is not even true of King Arthur, though some of the writers have pinpointed places where he probably was, but it's certainly not true of Santa Claus. When did Santa Claus, the original Santa Claus, live? Where did he live? Who was his mother? Nobody knows any of those things, but you know those things about Jesus, and it's particularly interesting that those who wrote about him claim to have known him, with the possible exception of Luke. And Luke goes out of his way to point out the fact that he had made very careful investigation from eyewitnesses so that he could be absolutely certain that the things that he was writing were true. And he is the one who is most careful to give us the very dates, though he doesn't say year and day, which was not common in those times. But he establishes the exact time of Jesus' life, particularly of the beginning of his ministry, by telling who it was that was on the throne in Rome and who were the governors of various provinces, so that you can pinpoint the very year when Jesus began his personal ministry. Let me read, for example, the first verse of the third chapter of the book of Luke. Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being high priests, the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness, and he went out preaching in the region. Now, that is a very precise statement of when Jesus lived. And you have the accounts of the city, as we've said, of Bethlehem, where he was born, of Nazareth, where he grew up, of Capernaum and Jerusalem, and the various places where he did his work, so that you can go there and find the very locations that Jesus, where Jesus lived and worked. Now, that is something different from legendary characters. He was an actual character who lived and moved and worked among the sons of men. But the second question that we want to ask is this: is he actually mentioned by any secular writers? I've been asked that a number of times. And I want to say that it's a strange question. You really wonder why people would be so concerned about whether he is mentioned by secular writers or not. I want to make a statement, and this statement you can make in any classroom and support. The Bible is the most accurate history that men possess of the ancient world. When the Bible says that a certain king lived and reigned and did his thing, well, you can be sure that he did. Now, there have been many instances when the Bible mentioned kings that were not mentioned in secular history, at least as far as any secular history that existed at the time or was possessed at the time. And there have been people that have just ridiculed the Bible about all these imaginary kings like Sargon. Well, true enough, none of the ancient historians mentioned Sargon. But archaeology, which is a rather recent science, actually dug up his palace and found the very place that he lived and sustained all of the things that the Bible had said about him. In the New Testament, there were questions about the island of Cyprus and whether or not there was ever a proconsul. Luke talks about the proconsul Sergius Paulus and claims that he was a proconsul on the island of Cyprus. And there were those based upon ancient historians said, why, the island of Cyprus never had a proconsul. That would be like talking about the governor of Atlanta. You don't have any governor of Atlanta. You've got a governor of Georgia, but there's no governor of Atlanta. But a coin was dug up by the archaeologists, not only of a proconsul in Cyprus, but of that very one, Sergius Paulus, which demonstrated that the Bible was accurate in its history. And I could read statements from various men who have operated museums about their observations. In fact, I heard one with my own ears in London. I went to the London Museum, or the British Museum, and heard the curator of that, which is perhaps the largest museum in the world, finest possession of ancient documents and ancient artifacts. And he said that there had never been anything discovered by archaeology that disproved anything in the Bible. In fact, he said there's a harmony between everything we found and the picture the Bible gives of ancient history. So if the Bible is the most accurate account of ancient times, why do we need some kind of ancient corroboration for what the Bible says? Well, there are those who say, well, but the Bible is just not accurate. You know, it's gone through all of these translations, and you can't really depend on it, and there wasn't any of it even written for years, and we don't have the original writings. But you know, that's not that we don't reject other writings on that basis. And I'm going to give you some examples. There was an author by the name of Thucydides, a philosopher who is highly regarded and whose writings are carefully studied in ancient literature. He lived from 460 to 400 B.C. And guess how many manuscripts we have? We don't have any of his original manuscripts. But there are only 8 manuscripts in existence. And the oldest one is from A.D. 900, which was 1,350 years after Thucydides lived. Aristotle is widely acclaimed and his writings are published. We studied a great deal about Aristotle in classes I had in school, in college many years ago, and he's still respected. But there are only 5 manuscripts of the writings of Aristotle, and the very oldest one we have was written and copied 1,430 years after Aristotle died, the year 1100. I also studied, and if you study getting into Latin, you study the writings of Julius Caesar, the wars of Caesar. And these were written, the oldest copy we have was 1,000 years after Caesar lived, and there are only 10 manuscripts of that. Now look at the Bible. The Bible was written, the New Testament particularly, between 58 and 98 A.D. And how many manuscripts do we have? Well, instead of 8, as in the case of Thucydides, or 5, as in the case of Aristotle, or 10, as in the case of Caesar, we have 20,000 manuscripts. Somebody said, "Well, but they are all. A lot of them were just copies. All of them were copies. But that was true of all the rest of these men. They were all copies." Yeah, but many of those copies were made long. Some of them were made. But we have copies that were made just 40 years after the original writing. Now, granted, not a complete copy. But we have portions that go back to 40 years after the New Testament was actually written. Well, but sometimes people say, those manuscripts don't mean anything because they're all different. Of course they're all different. Of course they are. Even printings of the New Testament and the Bible are different. I'm grateful, and this congregation ought to be grateful to Ross Statham for making us these copies of the New Testament, large print, so we can put them before us from time to time. I think that's a very effective. I feel real confident when I'm using copies of the text that way. But now and then, there's a little mistake in there. In fact, Ross anticipated that, said, if you find a mistake, let me know. But Cherry said the other day, he said, I think you need to check one of those with a word missing. Oh? Now that means it's different from other copies of the New Testament, even in English. But in the first place, how'd she know there was a word missing? Well, the sentence didn't quite make sense without that word. Well, would there be any way in the world we could know what that word is supposed to be? Why, of course. You've got many other copies of the New Testament. In fact, I could just ask you, take your Bible, tell me what word's missing there, and you'd be able to tell me from the others. Now, there's a difference. There's a difference. But you could supply it because there's so many other texts available in this very assembly. And so if there's a word missing in one of those 20,000 manuscripts, out of some of the others, you can supply the word without any problem. And that's the kind of mistakes they talk about. In any book as big as the Bible, in any 2 editions, even with modern printing, you're going to have some small differences. But that's the kind of differences they are. And the fact is that the large number of manuscripts we have simply makes it possible for us to go back and reproduce precisely, more so now than 100 years ago, what was originally written by the authors who wrote the books of the Bible. There's every reason for us to be confident in the books we have, and to say that if something is mentioned here, there's more reason to have confidence in it than if it was written by Thucydides, or Aristotle, or Herodotus, or some of the other ancient scholars. Well, but are there any? Yes, there are some. Now, I would say this, that the well-known Roman scholars of Jesus' day did not mention him. You wouldn't expect them to. Actually, some very important individuals in some remote part of the country, of the world today, might get by without being noticed by worldly known scholars worldwide. But it's more likely now, because in every country you have CNN or CBS or the newspapers. and they've got people there, and sometimes they don't have anything to report, so they'd look around to try to find something. If this had been ancient times, why, the Romans would have had reporters in the city of Jerusalem and in Galilee, and they'd have been sending their reports by satellite back to Rome so they could get on the late on the evening news. They couldn't find, and Jesus without doubt would have been, but that just wasn't the way it was then. Things that were going on in Rome were important to Roman historians, but what was going on out of the provinces just didn't make that much difference to them. But I'll tell you what, it wasn't very long till they began to make note of Jesus and of the followers of Jesus. For example, in the year 112, a Roman historian by the name of Tacitus, who lived from 52 to 54, or who was born somewhere around 52 to 54 A.D., wrote a history of the reign of Nero, which went back just a short time, really. And let me just read what he said about Nero, who perhaps put Paul to death. But not all of the relief that could come from man, not all the bounties that the prince could bestow, nor all the atonements which could be presented to the gods availed to relieve Nero from the infamy of being believed to have ordered the conflagration, the fire of Rome. Hence, to suppress the rumor, he falsely charged with guilt and punished with the most exquisite tortures the persons commonly called Christians who were hated for their enormities. Christus, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea, in the reign of Tiberius. But the pernicious superstition, repressed for a time, broke out again, not only through Judea, where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also. Now he's writing about a Nero who had lived not many years before, and he tells about all the problems that he had with these followers of Christus, or these followers of Christ. Tacitus has a further reference to Christianity in the fragments of his history, dealing with the burning of Jerusalem temple in AD 70. Lucian, a satirist of the second century, spoke scornfully of Christ and the Christians. And there was a man by the name of Plinius who wrote to the Emperor Trajan, told about the rapid growth of Christianity in his part of the world, which is around AD 112. And so those men were very aware that there had been a Jesus just a few years before, because now his influence had spread to the places where they were, and they made note of it. But the only historian of any note who lived actually during the time of Jesus and very soon thereafter was a man by the name of Josephus, who wrote the history of the Jews. And in his book, The Antiquities of the Jews, a chapter, well, it'd be book 18 and chapter 3 and paragraph 3, he said, "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man." That may have been said tongue-in-cheek, and many think it was. He was not a Christian. "For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was Christ, and when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct to this day." Now, some have questioned that, but the only reason they've questioned it is that they don't see why he would have said it. Well, the reason he said it was that it was so, and that this was exactly what was believed by millions concerning Jesus at the time when he wrote. The answer then to the second question, is he attested by other books? Yes. But what difference does it make? We have the account in the most dependable history of all the world, the account in the Bible. Now let's ask another question, and we'll pursue this very briefly. If Jesus didn't exist, where did this idea of this man come from? There have been those who have suggested that It was just the imagination of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that these men just created this person called Jesus. Well, let me say to you that if they did, they were the most notable literary scholars of history. We say that Shakespeare was outstanding, great as a writer, because of the characters that he invented and because of the words that he put in their mouths. But what character of Shakespeare could ever begin to compare with Jesus Christ, either as a character, as an influence in the world? There has been no... dramatic character. That was just not common among them. And so the miracle of their imagining Jesus is greater than the miracles that Jesus actually performed. But some say, well, there was a real Jesus, just an ordinary man. But he was a very good man. He was a very influential man. And so after he died, all of these stories began to be created and to be associated with him. These rather wild things about him walking on the water, feeding 5,000, and raising a man from the dead. Those were just legends that grew up. They sure did grow up fast. Now, there are some marvelous legends about King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. But it took hundreds of years for those to develop. And by the time those stories were told, the men that knew him, if there ever was a King Arthur, were long since dead. But these stories of the miracles of Jesus were in circulation while the people that knew Jesus and lived with him were still alive. And not only that, but there were numerous critics who were demanding proof constantly of what Jesus had actually done. Except that they really didn't deny what he had done. They simply denied who he was. Now, that just doesn't fit. Some have said, oh, well, but this came was to be accepted because it was just the Jewish ideal man. If Jesus was the ideal man, why was he rejected? He was totally out of sync with Jewish society in his time. Totally out of sync. He was unique among men, teaching them the very things they didn't want to hear, and being the kind of king they didn't want, and refusing to be the kind of king they did want. No, he was not just the ideal Jewish man. That won't fit. One of the most difficult questions that anybody has to answer, who would question the reality of Jesus as he pictured in the gospel, is where did he come from if he wasn't real, if he didn't really live? Well, we're going to close with one more question. Is there anything that you can hold in your hand that is some way connected with Jesus? And the answer is no, as far as anything that he held in his hand. In fact, you go back to the land where Jesus lived, and it's rather disillusioning, I guess, that you really can't stand on any spot, unless it's Jacob's well, and say this is a spot that Jesus stood on. You go to Bethlehem, and there's Bethlehem, all right, but you can't find the manger. You can go to Capernaum, all right, and there's a house they say that Jesus was in, but they couldn't prove it if their life depended on it. And you go to Jerusalem, and why, this is the street that Jesus walked. Well, the street where Jesus walked are way down, long way below that. This is what's been built up in more recent years. And this is the tomb, and some go back in the... They, you can't prove it was. Well, then, isn't there any tangible... Yes. Yes. And you are part of it this very morning.
Why are you here today? This is what the world calls Sunday. Why are you here? Well, I've been taught to be. Yes, you have been taught to be here. And generations before you taught you that. But where did Sunday come from, or the first day of the week, as a day of significance? The Romans didn't observe the first day of the week. It was nothing to them at all. Why did they begin celebrating? And even more to the point is, why would Jews, who had for centuries been celebrating the seventh day, suddenly abandon the seventh day and begin meeting on the first day? Why? And it took place just like that. It just took place immediately. What was there that was of significance enough to cause them to abandon the seventh day and begin the first day? Nothing short of the resurrection of Jesus Christ could have done. But it did. And that's the reason we're here this morning. And there is no other event in all history that could account for such a tremendous, sudden change in a day of worship. And then what we did just a few minutes ago, that little pinch of bread, that little taste of the fruit of the vine, where in the world did that come from? What could possibly have started a thing like that? A thing which has been continued over century after century after century. Now, if it was a big feast of meat and bread and potatoes or something of the kind, with gravy and some kind of very delicious wine or beverage that was provided in large quantities, you could understand why it'd be continued week after week, can't you? But it's not that. It's not that. It is a very simple little meal of a little bread, a little fruit of the vine. Why? How did it get started? Why has it been perpetuated? The only possible explanation is something happened to start. Just as something happened to start the annual observance of the Passover, something happened to start this weekly observance of this simple meal. And it was that on the night before he died, Jesus took bread and gave his disciples and said, "This is my body." And he took the fruit of the vine and gave them to them and said, "This is my blood shed for you for the remission of sins. This do as often as you do in memory of me." And having experienced that precious moment with Jesus, and having seen his crucifixion and then his resurrection, how could they fail to remember him in this simple little meal that he had asked them to take in his name? That's where it comes from. My friends, Jesus is real. Jesus lived and dwelt among men, faced the same kinds of temptations and problems that we face, and taught us how to live. He is the life, as well as the way and the truth. No man comes to the Father but by him. We're going to continue some thoughts relating to this lesson tonight, and then again next Lord's Day morning, the Lord will. And I hope that you'll keep thinking with us about Jesus. And I want him to become the most real person in your life. That's possible. That's possible. That's the way it must be. That's what faith means. And I believe that if we can, it'll be a revolutionizing influence and effect in our lives. And I trust especially that our children and young people will listen to these simple lessons, which I trust will help them to be strengthened in their faith in the reality of Jesus. Is there one here this morning, though, who understands who Jesus is and has not obeyed him? It's a delight week after week to encourage you to obey Jesus. You believe in him? come in turning from your sins to follow him and demonstrate your faith in his death and his burial and his resurrection by going through a likeness of that death, burial, and resurrection and baptism, being raised to walk in a new life.